Hello and a very warm welcome to another episode of Spiegel Reef Podcasts. My name is Dennis Spiegel and I'll be your host tonight. Before we get started, a little trigger warning. Yes, this will be an English episode. And I had the pleasure to have an amazing evening together with Leo from Leonardo's Reef. And before we get into the recording, I have to tell you a little bit about an issue I had on the technicality. And that was that I had a severe echo in my headphones while we were recording the podcast. And this leads to me being not as fluent, not as eloquent as I might have been, and I'm really sorry for that, but it was just terrible. I was hearing myself all the time in my ears twice, and it was always with a little delay, so it was always feeling like I was talking over someone. Okay, but sorry for that, and I hope you would still enjoy this wonderful episode, and now let's get to it. Hi, everyone, and thank you for joining us here at Spiegel Reef Podcasts. I'm very excited for this first, because this is the first English podcast episode that I'm going to record here, and I have a very special guest here today with me. With me is Leo from Leonardo's Reef, and Leo, thank you for making the time. Thank you for being part of the first English Spiegel Reef episode.
Well, thank you, Dennis. It's a great honor. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you so much. Leo, I'm sure most of our listeners actually know you or have been in contact with you and hopefully also have been in contact with your corals. But maybe you can take a second and introduce yourself to the very few that may not have met you before.
Yes, so I'm Leonardo, Leo in day-to-day life, and I'm a coral farmer based in the Netherlands, so very close to Germany. We're neighbors, as many of you will know. And we started coral farming a long time ago. In 2009, we started the business. And in the beginning, it was more aimed at aquarium maintenance, but gradually we moved to coral farming, and then in particular, acropora farming. Right now we're basically specialized in the farming of acropora corals, and we ship those over the whole of the EU. So almost every country in the EU we can ship to, and we do ship to on a weekly basis.
Amazing. So, as you already mentioned, you specialized in acropora, and what was the reason behind it? I mean, there are so many different corals out there. Why did you specialize on acropora?
That's actually a very simple question, because I really like them. When I started reef keeping almost 25 years ago, I was immediately fascinated by, especially staghorn corals, because, everyone knows that image of small fish swimming in between those branches. And it was something that I just wanted to replicate in my, at that time, still bedroom at my parents' house. So I was immediately fascinated by acropora corals, and that basically that stayed that way for more than 25 years now.
35 years ago, I had my first reef tank, actually. And then about 20 years ago, I took a break and I got back into the hobby about 2 years ago. And when I got back into the hobby, obviously everything changed, and you have been part of the whole hobby and trade for 25 years. So you have seen quite some changes in the hobby. If I think back 25 years ago, this was still all T5, I assume, or maybe metal halides, obviously, but...
Yeah, it was even T8. I started with the big T8 bulbs. I think many of you may not even know those, that very thick, I think 2-3 centimeter thick TL bulbs, which had a very low output. I think three of those T8 bulbs are similar to one T5. So you would really literally put your whole tank front to back full of these bulbs, and you still had a very low light output. And the more expensive solution was indeed metal halides. But as a teenager, that was far too expensive for me. So I had to do with the T8 bulbs.
But you were able to keep Acropora corals back then even? Or did that come later?
No, definitely not. When I just started, I started with star polyps, leather corals.
Yeah.
I was fascinated by those staghorns from the beginning, but I thankfully I was wise enough not to immediately start with those. But I think in 2006 or 7 maybe, I really started with serious Acropora keeping, and my first full Acropora tank was actually the Formosa Forest. Many old reefers may know that tank. It was basically a cube tank, 80 by 80 centimeters, totally full with staghorn corals. So that was my first tank where I really realized that fascination that I had since 10 years or earlier, probably. Yeah.
Yeah. Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can remember when the first stony corals actually became available. It's not true. They were available before, but when they came into reach for me, so there might have been a Valida maybe in between an Ensmann. And I think that's about it, what we had on Acropora back then, at least where I lived. And so what was your progression from a hobbyist to becoming a professional coral farmer?
Yeah, like I said, I started very early as a teenager with first leather coral star polyps, and that gradually ended up in me keeping a lot of Acropora. Between living at home, studying, moving out of the house, I stopped briefly with the tank, so I switched tanks a lot in that period because I had to move so much. But in 2009, I worked at a local fish store, as a side job next to my study. And, there were a lot of customers that needed help with setting up a tank or doing some tank maintenance or someone that takes care of the tank during, holidays, for instance. So I started doing more and more maintenance, for those people. And even after I left that local fish store, I kept those customers and even expanding the customer base. And many customers or many new customers that started up a tank needed corals, you know, to fill up their tanks. And I did have a quite a large tank at home at that time. So I provided them mostly with frags out of my own tank. And at some point, I started the frag tank next to my display at home. And slowly that became bigger, bigger, bigger until I thought, okay, I need to rent a designated spot for all my frag tanks to grow the corals because it became a little bit too much to do at home. And in 2009, I decided to become a registered business, first for the maintenance. But slowly that graduated more and more into farming acros. And I think my first coral farm outside of the house I had, I think six, 7 years ago now. And 3 years ago, I moved to a much, much bigger location and it became very serious. And it's basically my full-time job since a couple of years now. First, I did it next to my job as a lecturer in university, but I just do one day of lecturing right now because it became so much work that I really have to be there full-time.
Sure. So, how large is your coral farm currently? What's the volume?
Well, it's I just had some friends over from Austria the other day, and it's quite small if you compare it to other farms in Germany, but it's very packed and very efficiently. It makes a very very efficient use of the space. At least that's what they told me. It's 90 square meters in total, divided over two floors, so ground floor and first floor. And in total, I have 18 square meters of flat coral flat where I farm aquapora right now. So that's 18 meters in total by 1 meter of surface area, divided in three different systems and two quarantine systems.
Amazing. Yeah, so I already shared my story, how I actually came to place my first order with you. That was end of last year. So I have seen your social media presence quite a few times, and I was always on the edge if I wanted to actually reach out and order corals from you. But then I found out, first of all, I think I have seen your private tank quite a few years back on, I think it was Reef to Reef or Reef Central or one of those bigger US forums. I was on a long car ride and I listened into a different podcast and I heard you speak, and immediately I thought, okay, this makes all so much sense what Leo is talking about, and this resonates with me quite a lot. So I placed my first order, and to say the least, I was shocked in a positive way when I opened up that package. I have very seldom seen corals that healthy, and they were just looking like the images. I think I wrote that even to you. And that was kind of a surprise, because most of the time it's really hard to identify the frags and link them back to the pictures that you ordered from. But this was totally different. So you photograph all your acroporas in full spectrum light, I guess, or at least most of them. And this was amazing to see, and it makes me wonder, is that also how you actually run your coral farm? Is that also full spectrum, or are you more using blue light and more the US style of coral farming?
Yeah. Well, first of all, thank you. it's always very nice to hear it. It's like I said, it's a lot of work, getting customers saying these things always makes me it feels like it's worth it. I think because we are keeping reef tanks, I'm keeping reef tanks for such a long time, and even before the LED era, so I'm very used to a very wide full spectrum look for all the tanks. I run all the systems very full spectrum because I really believe that it's important to mimic nature as much as you can. So the closest to sunlight is probably the best for the corals to develop the maximum amount of variety in colors that the acropora can have. And I agree, I do agree, the corals look much, much better under LEDs only, especially with yellow glasses, except for maybe some corals like red or pinks. But to develop those colors in the acropora, in the tissue, I think full spectrum is very important. About the photography, we photograph the corals basically in the same light as we grow them under. So it's roughly a 14,000 Kelvin spectrum. So it is a little bit blue, but nowadays it would be considered very white. And it's in most tanks, it's a combination of T5 and LEDs. But T5 is really the main source of lighting, and the LEDs are more to extend the photo period in the morning and the evening to be able to work in the tanks a little bit longer, because the LEDs come on at 9 o'clock in the morning and they switch off at 11 at night. So that's a pretty long photo period, but those LEDs don't really add that much to the whole light intensity.
So why use them at all if you think they don't add much? And
Well, like I said, we start in the morning at 8 o'clock in the farm, with all packing up all the shipments and inspection of the corals, rearranging them. During the day we do a lot of maintenance, of course, and sometimes it goes on until 11 o'clock at night. So we just need that time from 8 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night. Not every day, of course, but we need that time to really be able to work in the tanks. And if the tanks are dark, we cannot do anything. So,
but you could use T5 lighting in lower intensity, right?
Yeah, but the T5s are on for 8 hours. So that's really the main source of lighting. But dimming the dimming the T5s is very bad actually for the lifespan of the T5 bulbs. And because we run a lot of T5 bulbs, right, we use them as efficiently as we can regarding to the lifespan. So they just switch on and off directly. They don't do any dimming, just to extend the lifespan a little bit more.
Yeah, I remember when the T5s were introduced into our hobby, and everyone was expecting them to last for at least 5 years on a single bulb. And yeah, it turns out it might not have been that optimistic, but yeah,
no.
I used to use T5 lighting and hybrid lighting as well. And I just switched about 2 months ago to full LED. And I was exchanging my T5 bulbs every 8 months. I expect if you're running a coral farm with mainly T5 lights, that's quite a lot of bulbs to change in a year.
Yeah, it's a ridiculous amount, actually. We do switch them every 12 months and not every 9 or 8 months. Definitely it's better to do that if you have just a few bulbs at home. But we do switch them 50% each time. So half of the bulbs are switched, and then 6 months later, the other half. So we basically have a very constant intensity of light, and you can stretch that lifespan a little bit longer. So 12 months for us is the most optimal between coral growth and the cost of replacing the bulbs.
But under the dotted line, you would still say that T5 lighting is superior for coral growth and coral health to LED lights even today?
I wouldn't say that. First of all, I don't have enough experience with LEDs. We do experiment a little bit with them, and they definitely have very good results, actually, in our test setups. But to be able to get the same overlap and the same spread that the T5s provide, you would need a lot of fixtures, and the initial investment is just extremely high. It would definitely cost you 30,000-40,000 euros at once to change everything over to LEDs. And for us, that's just not feasible at the moment. So if we want to switch, we will do it very gradually. We did some tests with the Orfec bars, the OR3 bars, and also with the Radeon G6, and those results are very promising. But like I said, we cannot do it all at once. But we will definitely gradually move over to LEDs more and more. Also, because they will be phased out sooner or later. It's not really known yet when and if that will happen, but it's just as metal halides. At some point, they will just stop producing them, or producing them in such a little numbers that the price will go up substantially. So we have to move over at some point, and we will do it gradually. Yeah,
it's scary and exciting at the same time, I guess. But yeah, I'm still not decided if I like the pure LED look on my tank at home, or if I want to reintroduce some T5 lives even. But as you mentioned, T5s will be phased out. I think they are already phased out for any usage except pet care in general. And I think there were two or three other use cases that were still allowed. But for everything else, yeah, they are phased out in Germany at least.
Yeah, you cannot really install them anymore in new offices, for instance, and that kind of appliances. Yeah.
Okay, but so now that it's just the two of us and maybe a couple hundred people listening in, but what's the magic juice in your Coroform? I just cannot get over how healthy and how strong your corals are. And if you look at the website, it's hard to not order just everything that you can see there. Every coral that you offer is really special. And I cannot even begin to imagine how long it took you to build this collection of amazing corals.
Yeah, well thank you. I'm afraid there's not really a secret, but maybe that's also the good part. But I'll try to share a little bit of what we do. I think, first of all, the selection of corals is very important. So we really hand select all the new corals that we acquire. So out of shipments, sometimes 300, 400, 500 pieces large, we will select the best 10, 20 corals, or at least the corals that really stand out, the corals that really stand out to me. And that's, I think, also based on experience. Sometimes a coral is brown, but it just has that something different that I know this will become something special. So I think it's just the eye of experience to really pick those oddball corals out of a whole shipment. And next to that, I think the farming of the coral itself makes it that all the corals that don't do really well or cannot really adapt to a home environment or to farm environments, they will be basically eliminated before they can even be farmed at all. So the corals that are actually growing in the farm, they have been proven to adapt very well to captive environments and color up really well and grow really well for us. So it's already a selection of everything that we selected from, only the most adapted and most colorful corals will survive. So I think all those factors make that, the corals that we sell are very happy. And other than that, we just keep all our systems as simple as possible. I also explain it on the website. We don't have any fancy products, fancy equipment, or any tricks or secret potions or whatever. We just we quarantine everything very well in our quarantine tanks. We don't do a lot of imports, so there's not a lot of corals coming in all the time. So we can really take our time with our quarantine to really get everything very clean, because the most important factor for healthy Acropora and thriving Acropora is a pest-free coral. And after it's pest-free, you can work on it, all the other factors. And strong light, strong flow, and relatively constant parameters are, I think, the top three ingredients for happy corals. And that's basically our philosophy, to keep those three in optimal form. That works really well for us. There's no really any other secrets, to be honest.
You're just not telling us.
Well,
so a couple of questions here. So you mentioned that you're selecting just very few out of hundreds in a shipment.
Yeah.
So what happens to the others?
They will be sold to other vendors, I think. And it takes a lot of effort, and sometimes we are actually waiting at the wholesale for half a day for the shipment to arrive, because if you really want to have those very special pieces, you really have to be on top of it. Yeah, but there's so many corals, so there's a lot of beautiful stuff left. It's not that we take all the good stuff out of it. And of course, many corals are already in the collection, so we don't select them anymore. But everything that stands out and that's something we don't have yet, we will definitely spot and select. Yeah.
I think you are the only coral farm that gives a pest-free guarantee. I have never seen that before. There might be others, but then I don't know them. So how is your quarantine process? Can you describe a little how long it will take for a coral that just came in before it will be sold in the shop? And what do you do to the coral in the meanwhile? So, for example, how do you feel about dipping corals? Is that something that will weaken the coral, that will maybe even weaken the biome of the coral and will then make it more receptive for other parasites or illnesses?
Yeah, well good question. First of all, the corals that we sell are between 1 and sometimes 8 years in our possession. So it's not that we import and resell after a couple of months already. But if we select new corals, if they arrive to the facility, they will go into the quarantine. And the quarantine contains two separated systems. They're totally separated from each other. And what we do is actually very repetitive dippings. So when they arrive, they will be immediately dipped before they enter quarantine number one. Then after a week, they will be dipped again and go to quarantine two. Quarantine one will be disinfected. And 1 week later, the corals will be dipped again and go to quarantine one again. Switching between those two quarantine tanks will prevent the coral of being reinfected after dipping. Because when you dip a coral and you put it back in the same system, the dipping doesn't really make sense. So that's why we alternate between those two quarantine tanks. And after 2, sometimes a little bit more, 2.5 months of dipping every week, and also visually inspecting the coral, because visual inspection is still, I think, the most important. Not only what comes off in the dipping, because after one dipping, probably nothing comes off anymore. But we do have a sort of microscope that not really enlarges everything 100 or 400 times, but it's more of a fancy binoculars. So it actually makes things 10 to 30 times bigger, and it's perfect to put a coral under and just visually inspect a coral for anything that crawls on it. And our philosophy is if anything is actually on the coral tissue, it must be something bad, because of course there are pods, there are small crustaceans, there are small, maybe bristle worms, other worms. They're relatively fine in my opinion, but if they're on the coral tissue, it's bad news. So they have to go. Yeah. So after those 2 to 3 months of repetitive dipping, the coral obviously is really stressed. In the best situation, it browned out. It's actually brown. In the worst circumstances, it's white or dead. That also happens, of course. But in most cases, it's quite browned out. Also because we keep the nutrient levels in those quarantine tanks a little bit higher. So nitrate phosphate levels are higher to really build the tissue of the acropora a little bit more. And lighting is very dimmed. So there's, I think, only 150 to 200 par in those tanks, just to give the corals a very calm environment. And after that initial 2 months, the coral is moved to a system which is basically a step in between the farming systems and the quarantine system. So it's some sort of observation tank, I would say. And that's something we very recently introduced. So that observation tank is quite big, around 900 liters in total. And that tank is just running exactly like the coral flats, basically. And the corals will be in the observation tank for a couple of months before even moving to the propagation systems, just as an extra precaution, an extra step in between the quarantine and the grower tanks. Yeah.
Wow, that's an amazing process. And as you mentioned, it takes quite a while for a coral to become available in a store. And obviously, there's also lots of risk for you to lose those very special corals, not only because they are stressed, but it's things can go wrong. And over 1 year period of time, you have to be really careful and diligent that nothing happens to your corals.
Yeah, so, for sure.
The more amazing it is that you can actually offer those corals to such attractive prices, I have to say. Because this is really, I mean, we are not talking about a coral that you could find anywhere else. So they are very, very special. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, that's amazing. And it's definitely great for us hobbyists to buy a coral that is pest-free, that it is also farm-raised, is really something that makes you feel a little better to buy this coral, because you know that there is at least a good chance that this coral will survive in your tank, and lots of others that are just frag shops or whatever, they will import corals, they will frag them up, they will send them out few days later, and they may not even have any growth. Yeah. They're always more gamble than anything else. So in the name of all hobbyists, thank you for the work that you're putting into those corals. That's really amazing. And you also mentioned that you keep your parameters fairly stable, but still I was surprised when I looked at your website. I think you mentioned certain ranges, so there seems to be fluctuations. It doesn't seem to be that you are doing everything to keep them at a certain number. It's a range that you're shooting for, I guess. So how important is stability? Is it only important in a certain range, or maybe it's not as important as we all being made to think, and so we have to buy fancy aquarium controllers and things that will help us to keep a certain value, especially on the dot. So for, I don't know, for our calcium, magnesium, nitrates and phosphates or whatever. Are we being too focused on numbers?
Well, I put the ranges on the website because I'm just trying to be realistic, because I don't think there are many hobbyists who really can keep their alkalinity very, very stable until one decimal or two decimals. And especially when you have a large amount of corals in a relatively little volume. We have so many Acropora growing in a relatively little volume that the alkalinity, calcium, all the other parameters can fluctuate so quickly. So if we can even keep it inside that range, I'm already very happy. And in my experience, when a coral is healthy, when it's it doesn't have any pests, it doesn't have to fight off anything, it can have some fluctuations. It's not a big deal for them, at least in our experience. And if it is, if there's a coral that really gets upset when the temperature is 27.5 degrees in summer, I don't want to farm it. So if it dies, it just, again, part of that selection process, if it's too finicky, if it doesn't like the parameters switching a little bit, I don't want to farm that individual coral. So I rather replace it with another coral that actually doesn't bother that much. So, like I said, farming is a constant, there's a constant selection going on for those corals that can handle those fluctuations a little bit. They can handle all the dippings that we give them. So, yeah, we try to keep it within those ranges, and we don't stress out too much if the alkalinity fluctuates a little bit over time. Of course, you shouldn't do crazy things, but the corals that we keep can definitely handle it. Yeah.
So what would you consider the most important parameters for keeping your corals healthy?
I think alkalinity is very important, and the phosphate levels. If you're able to keep those relatively stable, your corals will really thank you. Of course, salinity is another important one, because everything depends on the salinity level in the end. All the other parameters, but salinity is not something that can fluctuate very easily, unless you're doing really crazy stuff. But trying to keep the phosphate levels and the alkalinity relatively stable is important, in my opinion. Yeah.
And I've seen on your website that you're keeping your alkalinity in, let's say, normal ranges. So there's nothing crazy like driving it up to 10 point something, or
no.
You're just, I think, between 7.7 and 8.3 or something it was on your website. Mm-hmm. And what do you think about those influences coming from the US mostly, where they keep their corals at higher alkalinity in the hopes that they can actually entice them to grow a little faster? Is there something to it? Are there downsides of doing this, or what are your experiences?
From time to time we had a little bit higher alkalinity outside of that range. It does happen, and we do notice some burnt tips. So the tips of the acroporal actually look slimy. Yeah, in people will say burnt tips. They're not literally burnt, but they will become a little bit brittle and slimy. We did notice that. So that's, I think, a downside of high alkalinity. But the most important reason for us is that we still do water changes every week. And we just keep the parameters in range with the tropic marine salt that we use, just to prevent any fluctuations in alkalinity, for instance. So every system gets 10 to 15%, depending on the system, 10 to 15% water change every week. All the parameters are basically adjusted to that freshly made seawater. So we prevent any fluctuation.
So do you use any ICP services, or don't you need them maybe? Or
yeah, we do ICPs for every system twice a month. At the moment, we're using ATI for those. We don't really steer any parameters by those ICPs, so we're not adjusting anything based on the ICP. But if, let's say, kalium, potassium, or calcium is off, we, of course, do adjust those, but we don't steer any or don't adjust any trace elements based on the ICP. We just dose an all-in-one trace element solution and a little bit of extra iodine, and that's basically all we do for traces. But because there are so many corals in such little volume, relatively, like I said, alkalinity, calcium, potassium, magnesium levels will very quickly fluctuate the ratios in between those. So we need to do ICPs twice a month to keep the calcium, alkalinity, magnesium, potassium really in range, because I think those macro elements are very important to keep in range. So that's why we do the ICPs. We just trust on the all-in-one trace element blend to provide everything they need every day. And the ICP gives us an indicator. If any trace element is not used completely, it will actually build up. But that's not the case. So we know everything is used every day. So we're happy with that.
Hmm. So listening to you, it all sounds so easy. I mean, you're not doing anything out of the ordinary. You use an all-in-one solution for your trace elements. You're not there with 100 individual dynamic element trace bottles and dosing.
Yeah,
maybe I'm doing too much in my own tank if I listen to that.
Well, maybe it's because of the water changes, I think we did notice iodine. If we don't dose extra iodine, it will be chronically low. So we dose that extra. But I have been dosing extra iodine for long before the ICPs were even available. So I knew iodine was one of the most important trace elements. So I've always been adding those manually extra. And I guess I was right, at least when I look at the ICPs. But I think, I really think less is more. I think the best aquapora tanks, if I look on the fora, if I look online, the best aquapora tanks were actually built 10, 15 years ago, before roller mats, before LEDs, before ICP testing. I'm really a firm believer in keeping it simple and having the discipline to really keep up with the necessary maintenance. So clean your pumps in time, do your water changes, clean the sand bed, and really stick to it. Don't skip a week, because then you know disaster is in those moments where you just skip maintenance for a while.
Yeah, absolutely. If you're up to date on your maintenance, you can also just leave your tank for a couple of days if you have to. If you're going on a short break or a short vacation or anything, and you don't have to be concerned if everything is in good shape. And I totally agree. I like that you're still doing water changes. I'm personally also a believer in water changes. I do weekly water changes, and I think my tank definitely benefits from that. And do you use any kind of mechanical filtration on your systems?
No, we if you count the skimmer as mechanical filtration, because I think skimmer is a very important mechanical filtration. But other than that, we don't use any. We don't have any biomedia in the tanks. That's also an important thing. But we also don't have any roller mats or filter socks or anything. So we totally rely on the skimmer to take out all the particulate matter, but also all the dissolved nutrients, obviously. And everything that doesn't is not skimmed out will accumulate somewhere in the corner with low flow, and we will take it out on a weekly basis. So that's basically how we do it.
Are you using any activated carbon, any ozone or UV on your tanks?
Yeah, all the tanks have UV. Not a ridiculous amount of UV, but there's some UV on every tank, and we change the bulbs every half a year. So the bulb is quite fresh always. And our biggest aquapora farming system also has UV, but also in a very low concentration, only 12 milligrams an hour. So we have the smallest UV ozone unit, and it's on 50%. So it's a tiny amount of ozone and also a little bit of UV combined. And next to that, we also use some activated carbon, but also maybe half a liter on 3,500 liters in total. So it's a tiny amount of carbon, but it's also changed out every week, and also basically running 24/7. But very low, very very easy. Just in a old panty in front of the pump. So. No fancy filters or anything, just in an old panty. Yeah.
So, So why do you use UV on your coral tanks? I mean, yes, most people would use UV to protect their fish. But why are you using UV?
I think it's important to keep the water column as sterile as possible. All the beneficial bacteria are actually on the surfaces, on any surface basically in the tank, and those will convert all the nutrients into nitrate and phosphate in the end. But all the pathogens, the microorganisms that you actually don't want, they're very typically in the water column. So not only parasites, but also other bacteria that basically cause STN, RTN in corals. Those can spread through the water column, and that's why we want to keep the water column as sterile as possible. So that's why we use ozone and UV. I don't have any proof, of course, that it prevents any disease from spreading or developing in the tanks, but we don't have any of those issues with RTN in the tanks that much, next to sometimes a frag here and there. We also don't dose any bacteria for that reason, or any bacteria food, because we just don't believe bacteria need any food, or we have to add any extra bacteria to be beneficial to the tank.
So do you think that bacterial plankton is an important food source for corals?
Yeah, maybe in nature it is very important for the corals, but I think there's a big danger developing a large bacterial colony or bacterial colonies in the tank. First of all, you're also growing pathogens potentially on the coral tissue or anywhere else. Second of all, bacteria use a lot of oxygen. So in case of a power outage, I think all those bacteria can easily consume much more oxygen actually than all the corals and fish together. So we do have some backup system, of course, for when the power goes out. I think our tanks can run up to 8-9 hours with extra flow if the power goes out. But if you also develop a large bacterial culture in your tank, they also need oxygen. And I think it's just a potential risk. Actually, we did notice a significant increase in the pH at night when we just cleaned all the bottom the bottoms of the tanks and taking out all the detritus. You can actually visually see an increase in pH at night from 0.3, 0.2 pH. And that's just those bacteria respirate at night using oxygen. So for us, that's just not a good idea.
Makes sense. So do you feed your corals? Do you believe in feeding corals at all? Or do you think what you have in the water is enough? Or do you think it's a good idea to have either liquid or powdered coral foods, or even maybe amino acids that you want to add? Or
I of course believe corals need a source of food next to the light we provide. But the most important food source for the corals are fish in our case. Mm. So we try to feed the fish a very diverse diet. We try to feed some dry foods, mainly for the algae, the algae eating fish, the herbivores. But we also feed frozen foods every day, and those frozen foods consist of 5, 6, 7 different types of frozen foods, from small zooplankton, phytoplankton, copepods, mices, brine shrimp, lobster eggs, fish eggs. So we add in a lot of different frozen foods to provide a very diverse palette of foods, because we know everything the fish will eat, eventually the corals will eat as well. We don't use any type of specific coral food on a day-to-day basis. But if, for instance, the phosphate tend to be a little bit low, we do add some Easy Farm. That's a professional range of products by Easy Reefs. And that's a very oily liquid food that you can use to feed the corals directly. I'm not sure if they eat it. I didn't check it under a microscope, but for sure it increases the phosphates in a very effective way. We do add that a little bit when the phosphates tend to be a little bit low. But on a day-to-day basis, we just believe the fish will, you know, provide the corals with enough food to say so. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you mentioned in the very beginning that you're using the Tropic Marin salt.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
Yeah.
So you're using mainly Tropic Marin as provider for any additives or whatever you're using in your coral farms, or?
Yeah, we are working together with Tropic Marin. We use their salts, their trace elements. Also, sometimes when I have to add some strontium, we add extra strontium. Mm. So all those base elements, those most important elements, the balling system, the salt, the carbon, activated carbon, we use Tropic Marin products. Yeah, correct.
So you're also relying on balling, as I think I heard, just balling that you're using. So you're not using any calc reactors or anything, you're just purely dosing.
Yeah, we're dosing balling in every system. So that's the full balling, the A, B, and C part. And every tank is also has calc wasser reactor. So the calc wasser is added as basically to make up for the evaporation. So that's just a little bit of the total consumption of alkalinity and calcium, and the rest is provided by the balling system.
So that's very interesting. I think kalkwasser is something that really makes me wonder a little bit, because I can remember about 20 years ago, nearly everyone started using kalkwasser, and that at some point they all turned away from it. And I never really understood why. Yes, obviously, if you reach your volume in evaporation, then it might not be enough and you have to substitute with something else. But I now notice it comes back. How can you explain that? Or why are you using kalkwasser, and what are the benefits that you like about it? Is it just pH stabilization, or
it's the most economical way to provide calcium and alkalinity. So it's just very cheap. It's also very easy because it always adds calcium and alkalinity in the perfect ratio. So that makes it just a very easy solution, at least for some part of the total usage. Of course, the added benefit of increased pH is another bonus, especially at night. Can never hurt. I always used kalkwasser. I never stopped using it because I just thought it was so easy to use, and the risk, if you just think about your setup, the risk of anything anything happening is also very low. There's not a lot of dosing pumps that can just pump in the whole canister, or one dosing pump failing and the other one not, so alkalinity and calcium is out of whack. So it's just very easy, we always used it as the base of our dosing. And I think recently people started to focus more on pH and high pH. I think some influencers and farmers from the US started to talk about the benefits of high pH recently. And I think that that made Kalkwasser a little bit more popular recently again. And I think that's a good thing because, like I said, Kalkwasser is very cheap. And if you can spend your money on corals instead of very expensive bottles, I think it's always a good thing.
Definitely is. All right. So you mentioned that you are also experimenting with LEDs and other things. And I was wondering, is that something that you would do in your coral farm, or do you have separate systems for your experiments?
Yeah, we have separate systems for the experiments, so smaller tanks that are actually connected to the bigger system. So all the parameters are exactly the same. The only thing that's different is the lighting, so we can really compare it in a fair way. We recently, last summer, we built a new system on the first floor, only for our most precious mother colonies. And that system is completely shut off from anything that happens downstairs. And in those systems, we use the Orfec bars. And one of the tanks has a little bit more bars than T5s actually at the moment. So we also try to experiment there a little bit with heavy LED and a little bit of supplemental T5. So instead of relying on T5 and a little bit of LED, we try to switch it around there, at least on one system. And maybe gradually we will do that with all four systems on the first floor. So yeah, that's how we experiment. Downstairs, we have one system with Radeon G6 right now. Not very happy about those still, but maybe I just, you know, I have to give it a fair shot and just see what happens on the long term. And in about a couple of months, let me put it carefully, we will start to build a new display tank. And the display tank will be 3 meters 20 by 1 meter by 60 centimeters high. So it will be quite large. Yeah. And I'm still debating on what light to use for that system. I'm really going back and forth between LED, T5, metal halide. So it's all over the place at the moment. But it will definitely be something different than what will be on the other tanks, just as an experiment. And just to see how the corals respond under different lightings, because we also want to provide our customers with information about how the coral will develop and grow in their tank. So depending on what light they have above their tank, we can give them some more reliable information about how the coral will develop and grow. So we try to have different lighting setups to see how the corals will respond differently under those.
So I think on your website, you also stated that you're not only a coral farm, but you are also a coral laboratory. I think you are at least in the beginning phases of working with coral spawning and maybe even other things. Can you tell us a little bit more about your laboratory, what you're actually doing there and what the goal will be?
Yeah, actually, we see the whole farm as a laboratory. That's something many people don't know, actually. So we don't really have a store function, but I try to run the whole facility as a lab. Also because of my background, I'm a lecturer in the university. Like I said, I work mostly in the lab there. I've been used to working in the lab all day. So I try to incorporate that experience that I have also in the coral farm. I have the ambition to do some very practical research that is usable for hobbyists immediately. And you can think about pest control, how to treat different pests like flatworms. So we will make some setups, testing different substances and how they fight off flatworms. Could be in a dip, could be in tank treatments. So we have plans to do that kind of research. So very practical research that that's of course free for everyone to use and can be applied by hobbyists immediately. And I already mentioned the mother colony systems upstairs. They were built in a total dark room, so the room is totally shut off from outside light. Those mother colonies are obviously larger in size, are quite big, and we are trying to let them spawn in captivity by simulating moonlight, by simulating the yearly temperature fluctuations in the natural reef. So that's something that just needs time. I know there are more and more hobbyists and researchers that have success with captive spawning and also raising corals or raising the larvae that came out of the spawning events. So that's something we also try to mimic and try to realize in the farm. And first of all, just to get some experience with it, and maybe in the future, at some point, it will be commercially interesting. But for now, the most interesting for us would be hybridization, so the crossing of different species or different colors of Acropora to actually create new species. Basically, it's super exciting. So we're taking the first baby steps into that. I think it's something you just have to do because I think it's sooner or later it will be the future of coral farming.
Most likely it will be. Even though we still have to find out what we will do then with thousands of corals for one spawning, so we may have to have some regulations who spawns which corals or something.
The spawning is actually not the difficult part anymore, but raising the larvae, that's much more challenging, actually.
I heard that the settling might be the crucial part, how to entice them to settle on the substrate that you're providing.
There are actually some very, very exciting developments into that regard about coral settling. We start to understand more and more why the larvae settle in certain spots and why they skip others. So that's super exciting. But I think we learn new things every month, every year. Yeah.
So where did you get where do you get your current knowledge from in terms of coral spawning? Is it just, are you connected to other researchers, or is it just what you can read in papers, or what is your main source of information there?
Well, actually, both. I'm connected to some other universities out of my work, but also via Tropic Marin. They also have some connections with universities in Germany. Wilhelmshaven as well, in the north. Samuel Nietzer works there, and he's also very busy with the coral spawning project. But also just watching YouTube videos, because there are a lot of guys in the US as well and in the UK that have success with coral spawning, and it's very inspiring to see that they're just doing it in their garage and of course they're very knowledgeable guys, and they're definitely not playing around, so they're very serious about it. But it's very inspiring to see that with relatively easy methods and low tech, they can actually induce coral spawning and raise the larvae. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it will be exciting to see what the future holds for us in our hobby. I really like that you're also going to do some research on pests and how to treat them. I think this is one of the real issues that most of us hobbyists at least have to deal with. we most of the time don't have the luxury of having different quarantine systems and being able to basically quarantine them for a year before we can introduce them into our display tanks. Yes, you do the work for us, but obviously not everyone is doing the same. But I mean, yes, you have 25 years of experience, but for us hobbyists, what are things that we should be on the lookout for? So if we look at our corals, what should we look for in terms of possible infestations, or what might be early signs of some illnesses or problems, at least with our corals?
Yeah, good question. Well, I think when I specify to Acropora, when an Acropora is not growing, there's definitely something going on. And it can be, of course, many, many, many different things. But if it's not growing, it's definitely not happy. And the first thing I would do if a coral is not happy is dip it. It's a very easy way of, making sure that nothing's on the coral that doesn't belong there. If a coral is not happy, polyps are not extended, not growing, take it out and dip it. And if something comes off, then at least you have a part of the answer that the coral contains a pest. So signs of an acro being not happy is bad growth, not forming a base on the rocks or the frag plug. Poor polyp extension, poor coloration, can be very dark or very light coloration, can be both. And the nice thing about dipping is that it gives you an immediate answer. So if the coral comes out clean, then you can start searching for other causes like water parameters, flow, light. And those will definitely take more time. Because corals have to adjust to the new parameters if you improve them. Those are the most important things I would look for if a coral's not happy. And from there, you can just start with your list of trying to find the answer why it's not happy.
Very interesting. So one thing that makes me wonder, I do actually have a couple of corals that did not do much for the first 4 to 5 months, actually. So you place them in the tank, they start building a little bit of a base, and then they stagnate. They don't do anything. Yeah. And then after about 4 or 5 months, they suddenly start shooting up, and they just grow very fast and mm-hmm. like a sprint in between, and then they kind of start growing normal. So would you say this should be a sign of concern and should be looked into?
Well, I think it's very good that you say it, because sometimes a coral just need time to adjust. Obviously, when you buy a frag, it has been growing in our systems for a couple of years, has been used to our way of reef keeping. Then it's transported 24 hours in a bag in the dark. And then you open up the bag, you put the coral in the tank, and it's in a total different environment, not only in a different country maybe, but also in a different tank with different parameters, different bacteria colonies in there. So that coral needs time to adjust. So if the coral doesn't grow immediately or becomes a little bit darker, or doesn't show the polyps that you would expect it to have, don't panic right away. And of course, if other corals are doing very well in that tank, then probably the water parameters and the lighting are good. So you shouldn't worry about those. Yeah, corals also need time to adjust, and sometimes they just need time, to start growing. And it can definitely take half a year or maybe even a year for them to really start taking off.
You mentioned water parameters, you mentioned lighting and flow. So how important do you think flow is in relation to light? So you mentioned in the very beginning in your quarantine tanks, you dim the light a little, so you're 150 to 200 mm-hmm. micromoles. But what about flow? How important is flow in relation to the light?
I think flow is together with water parameters, I think flow is the most important factor in the health of corals, because all the respiration can only happen when there's enough flow around the coral. So I do think water parameters and flow are definitely more important than lighting. Probably not for optimal coloration and optimal growth, but for the survival of a coral, it's much more important to have decent flow. And if a coral gets bigger, so if a coral gets the size of a colony, flow even becomes more of a crucial factor, because that flow really has to penetrate even the center of that colony. And that's actually the one of the biggest, when you're an experienced reefer and you're able to grow big colonies, you enter a different stage of the hobby where you have like new challenges. And the biggest challenge is actually to provide good flow in a full grown reef tank. That's much, much overlooked, I think. And it's very hard thing to realize.
How would a hobbyist gauge if the flow is good enough? So it can always be better, but what is good enough? So if I see that the polyps are constantly in motion, is that enough? Or what would be an indicator?
All the polyps from the middle to the colony, all the way, if you look down from the top, all the way in the center on the bottom, to the far end tips on the outside, everything has to be moving. All the polyps have to be at least moving. That's the most important. But second to that, I think in my experience, some very strong but chaotic flow is something an acropora really likes. So very strong flow, but not from one side all the time. So it has to be turbulent. It has to come from many sides, but it can be actually quite strong, and corals can adapt to a lot of flow. So it's very hard to give a coral too much flow if the direction is very random and changes all the time. And that's something hard to achieve. You need definitely more than one pump to achieve that. That's something I would look out for, just very random turbulent flow and all the polyps moving all the time from the base to the far tips.
And besides the environment that you just described, very heavy flow and so forth, do you think there are other reasons why it might be good idea to keep acropora mainly only with acropora and not start mixing SPS and LPS and maybe even softies together in one tank?
Well, I think it's definitely possible if you keep the acropora colonies relatively small. I think when your acros start to become larger and become colony size, you have to provide so much flow that it will be hard to keep the LPS and the softies happy anywhere in the tank, actually, because the flow will be so high in every part of the tank that it will be basically impossible to keep any LPS. That's why we also don't keep almost any LPS. We have some LPS, some Gonia Strea, some Favia, but they're all on the bottom. So the bottom in some spots is suitable to keep them, but most places are just totally not suitable to keep any LPS because they will be ripped apart.
So when it comes to private tanks, not coral farms, would you be on the side of bare bottom or sand in your tanks?
I always had bare bottom tanks, even before they came popular. For that same reason, I keep 100% Acropora tanks, and in 100% Acropora tank, it's virtually impossible to put any sand, unless you have a tank that's maybe 70 centimeters high or 60-70 centimeters high. Maybe you can have a little bit of lower flow in the lower regions and keep the acros on top. But in a tank under 60 centimeters, if you have any sand on the bottom that stays there, you don't have enough flow. No.
Okay, I like that.
Maybe, you know, when you still have frags, it's fine. But when those frags become colonies, yeah, you have to take the sand out at some point.
Yeah, and I think this is very important also, that you're constantly on the lookout if the growth of your corals actually change the environment, and you may have to adjust flow and lighting as well. I mean, there could be shadowing now that your corals are bigger and they could shadow the ones that are in the middle or even lower in the tank.
Yeah, what we do for that same reason is from time to time we will reset a colony, we call it. So when a colony becomes quite big, the challenge to provide it with enough flow becomes harder and harder, and we will just cut up the colony in smaller pieces, just to make it easier to provide decent flow for them, and reduces the risk of anything, you know, going wrong inside of that colony. So we call it resetting the colony. So we make it a little bit smaller. We divide it in 2, 3, 4 smaller colonies and basically start over.
If you actually have a colony that got too big and you might not have had enough flow, you may have some die-offs in the center of the coral, for example. Is there still time to frag them, or are they lost in that point?
Well, if you're fast enough, you can snap off the healthy branches, far enough away from the dying tissue, and then you will definitely able to save the species. Of course, the colony is ruined. You will end up with a lot of small frags, but it's definitely possible to save it. But if you leave it for too long, sometimes the repetition necrosis can happen overnight, right? So you should, if you see something not right in the center or on the base of a colony, you have to act immediately, because if you think, okay, I will do it tomorrow, in some cases the whole colony is already gone.
Yeah, I think this is true for so many parts of our hobby. Never wait till the next day. And it starts obviously with the corals, but even you see that one aptasia popping up, that one fire anemone, whatever it might be. And if you're not reacting directly, it will make everything just so much harder to keep under control. Leo, thank you so very much. You dedicated so much time to us here tonight, and you shared so many insights with us. I'm still a little bit disappointed that we didn't get the recipe for the magic sauce that you're providing to your corals.
Maybe I have to sell it just in a very shiny golden bottle, and then
you could. I think you could just take some tank water and maybe some food coloration, and then sell it off. That's probably a good idea.
I will think about it. Maybe for the 1st of April,
very special batch for April's Fool's Day. Okay. Leo, thank you so very much, and we all will be following you closely on social media, and maybe you can just tell us where it's the best source to get up to speed with all your news and seeing your new corals. Is that your website, or is there any social media platform that we should keep close watch out for?
Well, you can follow us on Instagram, Leonardo's Reef, if you search for it, on Facebook, obviously, and on the website, leonardosreef.com. We have an update, new corals, what you see is what you get, and the CTO section is updated every Friday at 7 p.m. at night, so right after dinner and when the weekend starts. And you can also sign up to the newsletter. You will get a 10% discount if you sign up for any coral that you want. Doesn't matter. And you will also get all the weekly updates that we do in your inbox if you sign up for that.
Thank you so much. And by the way, the CTO section really is great because it gives us an idea on how this frag may look like in a couple of years, because we see a bigger colony, and this is really, really helpful to see the growth pattern, but also on how it will be presented helps us to find a suitable spot in our tanks. So thank you for that.
Yeah, we're currently expanding the CTO section. So we're trying to shoot a couple of new mother colonies every week. So they will be a little bit more every week.
Leo, thank you so very much, and have a great rest of your evening.
You too. Thank you for having me, and talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Hey guys, just a very brief note to the very end of this episode. Just for transparency, I'm not sponsored by any of the vendors or brands that I'm mentioning here. I'm also not receiving any perks. It is just me talking about my hobby, my experiences, and that's all. All right. Thank you so very much, and see you next time.